Baratheon figure, to which he took sharp exception. Let's just say that he is a man of large appetites and boundless pleasures, an honors graduate at Harvard Medical School who practices cardiology at Palestine Regional Medical Center by day and morphs into a river rat at night, a great mass of a man who is normally dressed in patched overalls and grimy cap, his hair gone thin and his beard gray at 52. Medicine is merely his profession. His passion is the deep woods where he composes poetry and essays in his head and, with a few exceptions, kills only what he can eat. The woods are the one place he feels complete. By definition, he wrote in an unpublished essay, successful hunters are inescapably conversant with the life's final instant. They take comfort in the reality that a leaden bullet will salve, for a while, their primal atavistic drives. So great is that drive that he has sacrificed everything, including his wife and children, to remain here. Doc was a pretty good basketball player at Palestine High School in the late 60s until he got kicked off the team because he thought the opening of hunting season was more important than practice. As he tells it, he applied to Harvard almost as a lark. 4 years later, he graduated magna cum laude with a degree in chemistry, then breezed through Harvard Medical School. He also found time to read nearly everything by William Faulkner, concoct an explosive that blew the heads off gray squirrels that nested near his dorm, and court his future wife, a fellow Harvard Medical School student named Susanna Bedell. Doc could have set up practice anywhere in the country, but to the dismay of the Harvard faculty, he chose to go home to East Texas, where he became a country doctor and a land baron. Although Susanna's roots were in Boston, she agreed to follow. The long-term plan was for them to live summers at their second home in Concord, Massachusetts, and winters at their ranch, the Big Woods. The name came from a collection of short stories by Faulkner. After the McFarland twins, Scott and Anna, were born in 1986, Susanna built a large internal medicine practice in Palestine. By the time the children had reached the fourth grade, however, Susanna had endured all the bucolic living she could stand. She took the twins home to the Boston area, where she lives and practices today. Doc sees Susanna every 5 or 6 weeks and accepts the separation as the price he must pay to reclaim his precious bottomland, to lovingly restore it to what it was before men with axes and plows started hacking it up a century ago. In an essay titled Squirrel Hunting Alone, he observes the mottled light on the forest floor and reflects on his wife's different outlook on life. He believes that what made Rembrandt's paintings special was his use of darkness, while she thinks it was his use of light. Those who hunt, he tells me, have an inherent difficulty with optimism. Doc has earmarked parts of the Big Woods for each of his children and believes that his son has the wiring need to pursue blood sport. He did a film on hunting for Concord Academy and almost got kicked out of school for joking about the Lee Harvey rule, Doc tells me, chuckling as he reaches the punchline, head shots only. A few hours of daylight remain when I arrive at the Big Woods on a Sunday afternoon. Doc is eager to get started, and soon we are in his Yamaha Rhino ATV, bouncing across miles of trails and roads that he has carved through the wilderness. Elsewhere on the property today are hunters, some Doc's friends, some not, who've paid a fee for the privilege of prowling the place. Doc's 17-caliber pistol rests against his leg, and his larger caliber 25-06 is wedged against my leg. To my relief, he hasn't brought along a gun for me. I discovered at age 10, when I picked up a dove that my dad had shot and felt life withdrawing from its small, warm body, that I didn't have the stuff to be a hunter. Cartwright, what a commie liberal like you needs to understand, Doc says in preparation for a lecture on the need for a flat tax. He pauses in mid-sentence. Unexpectedly, we are halted by a huge hole in the levee road. It's the work of beavers. Soon the hole will expand and fester until the levee collapses into the marsh he has worked so hard to protect. Doc's attention is focused on the spot on the far edge of the marsh, at least 80 yards away. All I can see is a glint where the sun breaks off the water's surface. But I recognize what is happening. Doc is slipping into his killing zone, a sort of catatonic state in which he loses touch with the external world. For the next few seconds, his energy, skill, and being are engaged in the process. In one fluid motion, he raises the pistol, aims, and squeezes off a round. I flinch at the crack of the 17 caliber and catch a glimpse of the mortally wounded beaver, flopping and flailing in final desperation before sinking to the floor of the marsh. "I Lee Harvey'd that bastard," Doc proclaims. The kill complete, he slouches in his seat and takes an enormous breath, his eyes half closed and dreamy, like a man who has just had good sex. That night, we meet on the porch of the Big Woods Lodge to drink whiskey and listen to our fellow hunters talk about their day, about the hunt, and about their dogs, which they agree are as important as their guns. "I had a really good time with my dogs," says one shooter, who returned with no ducks in his pouch. Normally, the marshes are alive by mid-December, but the warm autumn has yet to inspire many ducks to make the trip down from Canada. Deer and feral hogs, however, are plentiful, and some of the hunters will work until the early hours of morning, skinning and quartering their prey. I ask if any of them ever have regrets after they pull the trigger. A few admit they do. Doc says that he takes comfort in the knowledge that at least the poor creatures didn't die in a nursing home. Jim Autry, who has hunted deer all over Texas and heads up a video production company called Texas Deer Hunter, which sells hunting equipment and produces radio and TV shows about hunting, tells us that not once has he regretted a kill. "But I shot an American buffalo," he adds, "and let me tell you, it was almost a religious experience." Doc rolls his eyes but says nothing. Later, we drive to the processing barn, where a bloodied doe, her eyes permanently frozen in horror, hangs from a hook while skinners undress her. The young woman who killed the doe, a high school ag teacher, drinks beer and talks in an excited voice about her day in the deer stand. As she was preparing to shoot, she accidentally sat in a bed of fire ants, leaped up, broke her nose on the window frame, and made a clean kill. I sense that this is a day she won't forget. On most mornings, Doc wakes early, reads 8 newspapers on the internet, devours a hearty breakfast of eggs, sausage, and pancakes, then hurries to his office to warn his patients to mind their diets. This Monday morning, however, he sleeps late for the first time in months. We spend most of the day riding the estate in the Rhino, spotting bands of deer, but shooting nothing, for which I am grateful. After a time, we stop and walk through the woods, overwhelmed by the silence and the sensation that we are the last people on earth. In a recent email to me, Susanna explained, "As to the blood sport, it is not the blood that truly engages me or Bob with hunting. It is the still, active quiet of the woods, the sun coming up through the stark woods, the quiet, the listening, the quiet, the listening." Although the present course of the Trinity River is several miles away, its meandering history is recorded in the diversity of the land where we are walking, alternating parcels of sandy loam, black clay, oxbow lakes, great open meadows, and dense tracts of oak, elm, cedar, and pine trees. Land in the Trinity floodplain is virtually useless for farming and ranching, but that hasn't stopped people from clearing the woods or draining the marshes or otherwise destroying wildlife habitat. In this magic setting, where solitude trumps a lifetime of casual beliefs, Doc's ranting about the evils of the tax code seems to make sense. As an example of how it encourages people to make environmentally destructive moves, he tells me about an old patient of his who clear-cut 12,000 acres because growing grass instead of trees reduced his tax bill. Doc is a practical breed of conservative, one who believes that the death penalty is underused, that drugs should be decriminalized and treated as a public health problem, and that the environment should be protected because, among other reasons, it's a good political issue for Republicans. Despite his distrust of government, Doc has made huge improvements to his property by tapping the government's wetlands restoration programs, which require pipeline, energy, and utility companies to pay landowners to plant trees and replace wetlands the companies destroy. He compares his mission to restore the habitat to Fitzcarraldo's quixotic quest to haul a boat over a mountaintop. Since returning to Texas in 1984, Doc has bought and restored hundreds of acres of endangered bottomland hardwood, including part of what used to be his family farm and boyhood hunting ground. He has organized other landowners into the Middle Trinity River Basin Conservation Cooperative, which now covers 190,000 acres of a river bottom. Conservatism and conservation are first cousins, he tells me. My holy grail is to make money off my land without raising cows. I hate cows. Trees that took 100 years to grow and 5 minutes to fell are being systematically replanted. 1 acre of floodplain can sequester 600 tons of carbon, Doc calculates, and if the Bush administration ever makes a carbon market possible, he figures to clean up. That's not all. He plans to pump groundwater into the river and sell it downstream to the city of Houston. And that wastewater that Dallas is so eager to get rid of, it travels downriver and helps refurbish his bottomland hardwoods. Every time someone in Dallas flushes a toilet, he jokes, I get a new oak tree. I read somewhere that in the 5 years from 1992 to 1997, Texas led the nation in loss of undeveloped land. Every 2 minutes, another acre of Texas farmland or open space becomes a subdivision, or a mall, or a road. Until today, I regarded the big woods as merely a place to hunt. Suddenly, I appreciate it as the living preservation of our Texas heritage. And if Doc can make a buck saving it, more power to him. An hour before sunset, Doc's high school pal, Dick Swift, a lawyer and former state representative from Palestine, joins us for one last attempt at bagging a Boone and Crockett-sized buck. Swift sits in a folding chair on the small bed of the rhino, his rifle across his knees. I try to shield my face from the spray of mud as we head for the river, bumping and sloshing through ankle-deep marshes and ribbons of black gumbo. When we reach the river, Doc follows its bank to a wide clearing and parks in a clump of trees where the deer won't see us. It's freezing cold. Doc pours cups of straight whiskey and passes them around. There was always a bottle at the hunting camp, Faulkner wrote. Those fine, fierce instants of heart and brain and courage and wiliness and speed were concentrated and distilled into that brown liquor which not women, not boys and children, but only hunters drinking not of the blood they spilled, but some condensation of the wild, immortal spirit. Mercifully, no deer venture into the clearing, and we spend the twilight hour drinking and joking in soft voices and trading tales of daring do and folly. It's dark by the time we head back to the lodge. Billions of stars illuminate the night sky. The only sounds are yapping coyotes, hooting owls, and wind rustling the naked treetops. I feel cold, but alive and complete, and, for the moment at least, pumped by that primal, atavistic drive only hunters understand. I started to say, we hunters, but you know what I mean. The Texas Monthly Hunting Guide. A rundown on where, how, and when and what to hunt around the state. From the September 1973 edition of Texas Monthly. For most outdoorsmen, the new year begins on September 1st, not January 1st, as observed by the rest of the world. Just as the first norther awakens the virility of the buck deer and fills him with energy that has slumbered all summer, the hunter comes alive. Some even take to jogging, doing push-ups or otherwise exerting themselves for the first time in months. On the first day of the season, they spring out of bed as the alarm goes off, although they normally can't be dragged out of bed with a winch truck. Getting back to this most basic skill helps change the pace and perspective of life in a 100-mile-an-hour world. Hunting is one of the most therapeutic strategic withdrawals available. Sitting on the side of a hill out in the Frio Canyon, a hunter can feel things falling back right into places as it gets on toward 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's the autumn of another year in his life, and a good time to reflect. So much for psychology. What does Texas have to offer hunters in the way of game? Over 3 million deer for openers. That's about one-fourth of the entire nation's deer population, and they are annually taken in about 214 of Texas's 254 counties under widely varied circumstances. If a hunter is up to it, he can assault the mountains and canyons of West Texas in the land known as the Trans-Pecos. Chances are he'll get a shot at mule deer and maybe two kinds of whitetail the same day. Or he might be after a real trophy for his den in the tangled catclaw and prickly pear world near the Mexican border, known as the brush country. Some of the best whitetail racks of all time have come from that southland. But if he prefers picturesque rolling hills with sparkling streams, where the deer and turkey abound in awesome numbers, and where each vista looks like a pearl beer ad, he really ought to hunt the hill country. The deer aren't the largest, but it's the greatest concentration of them in the world. In the panhandle, he can hunt a brushy draw along the Canadian River, where Texas's heaviest deer hide out. And the hilly area of the Possum Kingdom region provides thousands of whitetails for hunters west of Dallas-Fort Worth. Even East Texas offers good hunting in the heavily timbered land along the Louisiana border. The state's midsection, too, the Central Oak Prairie region, in many places is lush with oak thickets and acorn-fat bucks. But there's plenty besides deer. Over half of America's wild turkeys are Texans, and much of the country's waterfowl winter here. This is the end of the line for those traveling the Central Flyway from Canada. Likewise for sandhill cranes coming from the north to light in West Texas. Nearly 10 million quail, 14 million mourning doves, 250,000 white wings, and 1 million squirrels go into the stew each season. There are still more javelinas, 150,000, than pronghorn antelope, 10,000, in West Texas. Then, for those who want something out of the ordinary, come now the exotics, Those critters not native to Texas, or in most cases, not even native to this country. Some, like pheasant, for instance, or prairie chicken, have been imported from other states. The most exotic ones, though, are the ones that didn't speak English at all before coming to Texas. A glossary of game which can now be hunted in Texas reads like a Swahili roadmap. Oryx, audaz, nilgai, mouflon, axis, barasingi, black buck, and a good many others. Probably no area in the world offers a hunter such a divergent choice of game or hunting terrain for the $5.25 cost of a resident hunting license. See the subsequent information on licensing requirements. And there's an open season on something all the time. Deer and more deer. But the real madness comes with the opening of deer season. Although more people may hunt doves than deer, the dedication of the deer hunter is unsurpassed. As much as a day and a half before the season opens, traffic starts getting heavy on the highways leading to the Hill Country and South Texas from Houston and Dallas-Fort Worth. A truck driver on IH-35 asked if war had broken out. "Man, I haven't seen that many Jeeps since VJ Day." No matter the method, more deer will be taken in the Hill Country than in the entire rest of the state. Llano County, which claims to be the deer hunting capital of the world, iced down 17,121 head last year. Other counties which are traditionally productive are Mason, San Saba, Gillespie, and Kerr. The season runs from November 17th to January 1st. And the limit is 3 deer, no more than 2 of which may be bucks. The Hill Country may have the most deer, but the real trophies are elsewhere, like in the brush between San Antonio and the border. There's something about this land of everlasting brush, this one big undulating prairie of thorns named mesquite, wisatch, wahilo, catclaw, and prickly pear, that grows big deer. Not only are the deer larger than any in Texas, except those along the Canadian River, their antlers are the largest in Texas. The mineral content is ideally balanced for antler development. They call this manana country, and aptly so. The opening of deer season often falls on a day too drowsy and warm to worry about deer hunting. This is particularly true in McMullen County, where the season opens November 1st. The rest of the region opens on November 17th and closes January 1st. Up to now, the discussion has focused upon white-tailed deer, but Texas mule deer, too. Most of them are in flats and mountainous areas of the Trans-Pecos, but the herd in Paladura Canyon in the Panhandle is increasing. Hunting in these areas is usually initiated by vehicle and completed on foot. Hunting time is often far better spent slowly moving along the rim of a canyon, glassing the sides and floor with binoculars. Occasionally kicking a rock off into it will sometimes wake some game snoozing unnoticed by the hunters. An oddity to Trans-Pecos hunting, which is intriguing, is that it is the only place where 3 different kinds of deer can be taken by the same hunter on the same day, if everything works to his favor. In addition to the mule deer and whitetail, isolated parts of Brewster County have a little deer called a fantail, weighing only 60 pounds and characterized by an extremely large and broad tail. The fantail is a subspecies of whitetail. Hunting the 3 deer could result in 3 trophies. The mule deer and whitetail qualify because of their size and antlers, and the fantail due to its novelty. Mule deer and whitetail deer season in the Panhandle is November 17th to December 2nd. In the Trans-Pecos, the season on both species is November 4th to December 9th. But Terrell County and Pecos County have a slightly longer season on whitetails, November 24th to December 16th, due to the increasing population of them. As if that isn't enough hunting, Texas also has liberal squirrel hunting, with open season and no bag limit in many counties. But Texas hunting has far greater rewards than a little exercise, a few laughs around the campfire, and something different to put on the table. It is indeed a broadening experience for the urbanite. And it provides an opportunity to leave the day-to-day problems that cloud perspective to the point that the inconsequential can become blown all out of proportion to the greater blessings in life. After returning from a hunting trip, former Governor John Connally spoke of the unhurried atmosphere he found at daybreak or around a campfire at night and what it did for him. It tends to bring into focus, Connally reflected, the fact that whether you live the biblical 70 or not, your time is limited. Nothing can be more dramatic than the evidence you see all around you. Life is fleeting at best, and you regain a sense of values. If hunting can do that, maybe everybody ought to try it.
Hi, this is Linda. In defense of just eating your dang Thanksgiving dinner at Luby's. The holidays are stressful. Two words that offer an oasis: Luann Platter. By Dan Solomon, from the November 21st, 2017 issue of Texas Monthly. Maybe you're the type of person who watches videos of people deep frying turkeys year round, tucking them away on a Pinterest board full of Thanksgiving inspiration. Maybe you harvest your own cranberries to make a homemade sauce that bears no resemblance to the gelatinous, can-shaped blobs that define the holiday condiment in the popular imagination. Maybe you've got an overstuffed binder full of ideas for how to make the perfect ham glaze, Tabasco plus grape jelly plus brown mustard, that you wait all year to deploy. Maybe you get up at dawn on Thanksgiving to hand knead the dough for your famous rolls, risen twice before baking, with a pot of boiling sweet potatoes raring to go. If so, cool. Click on to the next article and have a great Thanksgiving, and feel free to tag us in the Instagram photos of your feast. It sounds amazing. If you're still here, let's get right to it. The holidays are stressful. They're a lot of work. Thanksgiving requires some degree of sacrifice just a month before another, even more stressful holiday season for most Americans. If you're not cooking Thanksgiving dinner, you're probably traveling. If you're not traveling, you're enduring the company of uncles and cousins and friends of uncles and friends of cousins you'd rather not see, hoping that the football games are competitive enough to help you tune out political rants from people who, if not for a shared connection on your family tree, you'd probably cross the street to avoid. At the same time, Thanksgiving dinner is a tradition. There's something exceedingly lonely about sitting out a holiday entirely, boiling a pot of pasta on the stovetop to eat with butter and garlic powder with the lights off, while at homes across the nation, everyone else sits down to a holy storm of turkey, potatoes, cornbread dressing, and green bean casserole. For those of us who want to experience the good parts of Thanksgiving, while also being able to avoid the parts of the holiday that spike our cortisol levels, there is an option. It's called Luby's. Luby's occupies a special place in the hearts of many Texans. The Luann Platter was a staple of a lot of people's childhoods, a place where they watched their grandparents eat liver and onions while they enjoyed chicken fried chicken and mac and cheese. It's in more than 40 cities in Texas, which means that it bypasses the occasional regional prejudices that Texans tend to exhibit. Luby's tastes the same in El Paso and Beaumont, in Weslaco and Mesquite, in Austin and Longview. It's a place that fills many of us with various feelings, and none of them are bad. And they serve Thanksgiving dinner there, too. On years when financial, coronal, or geographic realities made a trip out of town to spend Thanksgiving with family impossible, I've looked for a way to have a Thanksgiving experience on my own terms, and Luby's has been an above-average choice. There aren't a lot of restaurants open on Thanksgiving. IHOP, Denny's, Waffle House, and the like stay open, but who wants pancakes for Thanksgiving dinner? But Luby's would rate highly, regardless of the competition. The appeal of Luby's on Thanksgiving is largely that it serves Thanksgiving dinner every other day of the year, too. It doesn't need to gussy up its menu in an attempt to offer a special Thanksgiving menu. Roast turkey, mac and cheese, sweet potatoes, and rolls are a perfectly acceptable Luby's meal on any given Thursday. It's not veering off into unconventional territory, like the pasta-themed Thanksgiving dinner offered by Maggiano's Little Italy at $49.95 a plate, or entrusting a restaurant that mostly does mediocre burgers to serve up a delicious turkey dinner. Looking at you, Applebee's. Rather, it's the occupant of a perfect Venn diagram between Thanksgiving and casual dining. There are times in a person's life when a Luby's Thanksgiving might not be the ideal way to celebrate. When there are young kids involved, or aging parents, or other responsibilities that make attending or hosting a Thanksgiving dinner in a family home the most responsible way to treat the holiday, then even the chain's Thanksgiving special, turkey, dressing, two sides, and dessert for $11.49, is unlikely to provide an acceptable alternative. But if you spend a couple years celebrating the holiday with a few friends at Luby's, where someone else has to do all the cooking and cleaning up, and the only loud uncles in the building are not your own relatives, you might find that when it's time to celebrate Thanksgiving, that $11.49 special sounds pretty good.
Hi, this is Laura reading for Texas Monthly Archives. Pecan Dressing, You Are Welcome to Stuff It, by Courtney Bond. Published November 2013. Around this time of year, if all goes well horticulturally speaking, the state nut of Texas commences to rain down upon us, and after battling bushy-tailed marauders bent on stockpiling every last one, we turn our minds to what to do with our hard-won prize. Sure, pecan pie is nice, but since we're already in a combative mood, let's make stuffing. Or is it dressing? A once-a-year indulgence for most, this humble side dish nevertheless gets folks seriously worked up. Everyone has his or her favorite, and there would be moms. We cast a wary eye at any tabletop transgressors. Is that fruit in there? Wait, are those oysters? As if our family's very integrity were bound up right along with the celery and sage in that warm mass of stale bread. Freighted as it is with holiday nostalgia, it's no wonder we argue over everything from where to cook it, whether you like the hereby texture in or out of the bird seems to correlate with whether you grew up in or out of the South, to what type of bread to use. The one thing Texans agree on is that it must contain cornbread. In the interest of keeping things civil, here's a simple traditional version that you can doctor up any way you see fit. If we baked it in a casserole dish, but you are, of course, welcome to stuff it. Serves about 15. 10 cups dried bread. We did half white bread and half, not sweet, cornbread. 3 cups pecan pieces. 2 large sweet onions, minced. 3 teaspoons salt. 1 teaspoon pepper, 3 teaspoons dried sage, 1 teaspoon paprika, 4 cups whole milk, 1 cup melted butter, 2 eggs slightly beaten, 2 cups celery chopped. Tear bread into small pieces, add pecans, onions, and seasonings. Stir in remaining ingredients in the order given. Bake in a casserole dish or two at 325 degrees until crispy and brown around the edges, about an hour. Adapted from Down Home Texas Cooking by James Stroman, published by Taylor Trade Publishing.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I'll be reading today from Texas Monthly. Title of the article, Happy Turkey Day, written by Chuck Matula. Published January 21st, 2013. Texas may have a reputation for being unforgiving when it comes to crime and punishment, but the Lone Star politicians do consistently have one soft spot, pardoning turkeys. According to an article at NBC News, the National Turkey Federation has been presenting the Commander-in-Chief with a turkey in a ceremony since the days of Truman. But the bird was typically eaten. That is until 1963, when John F. Kennedy spontaneously granted his fortunate fowl clemency. Since then, the presidential turkey pardon has become a beloved tradition, meaning all three of our Texas presidents have commuted a bird or two. Occasionally, these pardons make history. In 2002, George W. Bush pardoned the first ever female turkey, Katie, in a gesture that won high praise from the female turkey community. In 2005, the pardoned bird, Marshmallows, went on to become the honorary Grand Marshal of Disneyland's Thanksgiving Day Parade. So how exactly are these lucky turkeys chosen? At the TM Daily Post, we theorize that the turkey is a close personal friend of the president, or perhaps a particularly generous campaign donor. However, a 2011 U.S. News and World Report article cruelly disabused us of this notion. National Turkey Federation spokeswoman Sherry Rosenblatt said the birds are specially selected at birth to be part of the pardoning ceremony. They are exposed to music, hand feedings, cameras, and loud noises to prepare them for the event, covered by the White House press corps. It's kind of like a beauty pageant, Rosenblatt said. The turkeys have to look good on camera, but also have to have a nice demeanor. They have to have pride in the honor that is bestowed upon them. Whether the birds earn their honor or not, though, they come out of the event with some photos they can cherish for the rest of their long pardoned lives.
Hello, this is April reading Sweet Potatoes with Ginger, Pecans, and Jalapenos. Recipe from Robert Del Grande, Houston. By Texas Monthly. Issue, November 1991. 4 pounds sweet potatoes, 4 tablespoons butter, 4 tablespoons flour, 3 cups milk, 1.5 teaspoons salt, 1/2 teaspoon black pepper, 1 tablespoon finely chopped fresh ginger, 4 jalapenos stemmed and cut into 1/8 inch thick rings, 1 cup chopped pecans, 2 to 4 tablespoons brown sugar. Roast sweet potatoes on rack in 325 degree oven until soft, about 60 minutes, depending on size. Place pan in bottom of oven to catch drippings. Allow to cool to room temperature. In saucepan, melt butter. Stir in flour to form a smooth blonde roux. Remove pan from heat. Add milk to roux in small portions, stirring vigorously to prevent lumps. When all milk is added, return pan to heat. Stirring continuously, heat mixture until it is slightly thickened. Remove from heat and add salt, pepper, and ginger. Keep warm. Preheat oven to 325 degrees. Peel cooked sweet potatoes and slice into 1/2 inch rounds. Lay rounds like shingles over bottom of 9 by 13 inch casserole dish. Sprinkle jalapeno rings and chopped pecans over sweet potatoes and pour milk gravy over them. Sprinkle brown sugar over the top and bake for 30 to 40 minutes or until bubbling. Allow to cool 15 minutes. Serves 8 to 10. Recipe from the Right Stuffing, Texas Monthly, November 1991.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Texanist, offering fine advice since 2007. By David Courtney, issue February 2013. Q. The area where I live is blessed with an abundance of pecan trees. During this latest pecan season, there was a heated discussion on my neighborhood listserv about people coming into yards to collect pecans without asking the homeowners first. Some were fine with it and others were not. What's your take? Courtney S., Austin. A. The pecan tree, a.k.a. Carya illinoensis, is the official state tree of Texas, the producer of the official state health nut of Texas, a provider of good shade, and the origin of innumerable delicious pralines and pies. The Texanist is the proud owner and overseer of a particularly beautiful specimen, which towers nobly over his front yard. Yet, while the tree did indeed put out like a trollop last year, the Texanist did not witness anybody traipsing into his yard for the purpose of getting after his own precious nuts. At least in his neighborhood, the old Texan taboo against trespassing, so deeply ingrained in our rural areas, seems to have survived the widespread citrification that has crept like a plague over our once more pastoral state. And that is, the Texanist has just been reminded by his editor, the theme of this month's special issue. However, for the purposes of advice giving, let's suppose that some clueless recent immigrant from, say, Los Angeles, had intruded into his one-tree orchard. It's safe to say that the Texanist would not have suffered the fool lightly, addressing him with the disdain that he saves for pesky squirrels and suspect mechanics, perhaps even punctuating his tirade with a menacing reference to a can of whoop-ass. It does not hurt to occasionally frighten these newcomers. We must all defend against the cultural watering down that is the byproduct of the massive migration of peoples from other states to our Texas cities. Sometimes, fear is the best instructor, and everyone should learn that without prior arrangements, a person's pecans are best left untouched. You are encouraged to share this view with those on your neighborhood listserv, some of whom, let's face it, might be from Seattle. The Texanist used to subscribe to his neighborhood listserv, but he found it to be overly saturated with absurd rants against lemonade stands and leaf burning, and not saturated enough with announcements of upcoming pie socials.
Hello, this is Michael, reading for Texas Monthly Archives. I'm going to read a story that is quintessentially 80s and very appropriate for this time of year. The Culture, Texas Primer, The His and Her Gift, The Whole World is Waiting, What Fabulously Expensive Gifts Are Texans Giving This Year, by Susan Chadwick, published December 1985. A Christmas gift, a thoughtful gift, is that special something that somebody wants or needs or dreams about. As the whole world knows, what Texans give each other at Christmas time is white mink chaps, backyard ski slopes, his and her submarines, and baby buffalo. The whole world knows that because every year, everybody opens his Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog to find out what extravagant gifts those fabulously wealthy Texans are bestowing upon their loved ones this season. Those who are not privileged to receive the Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog read all about it in the newspaper, for, invariably, the his and her gift, traditionally the most imaginative of the catalog items, is reported with glee, confirming what everybody already knows about Texans. They are a bold, generous, and fun-loving people, with so much money that they have to come up with all these outrageous and unashamedly tasteless ways to spend it. I know that I was stunned at a tender age by reading about the his and her gifts. It wasn't just the things themselves, but the realization that I was supposed to be able to have them. The two-passenger submarine, billed as the ultimate in togetherness in the 1963 catalog, was 14 feet long and cost $18,700. It struck me as romantic, but I was also impressed with the backyard ski slope. Only a minor feature in the 1966 issue, the ski slope was 121 feet long and 25 feet high, and it came equipped with lights for night skiing. It sold for $100,000 and was really the perfect thing for Texas since there weren't many places to ski here. I thought, well, I'm a Texan. Is my daddy going to buy me a backyard ski slope? There wasn't even the slightest chance of it. Among other problems, our backyard was too small. It caused quite a strain, this difference between the world as I knew it and the fantastic world as presented in the catalog. But was it real? Do rich, happy Texans sit around the Christmas tree in his and her ermine bathrobes and exchange gifts of airplanes, camels, mouse ranches, and sterling silver choo-choo trains that roll around the dining table laden with gravy and mints? Do they telephone and simply charge up pink and white striped hot air balloons, dinosaur safaris, and 10-pound, $35,000, 24-karat gold wigs? Neiman Marcus is appropriately tight-lipped about the purchases of its clientele, as well as a bit hazy on the fate of some of its exotic items. But it is common knowledge that Irma, the camel, from a pair designated as the ideal his and her gift for 1967, sold at $4,125 each and resides comfortably at her estate in Fort Worth. The $27,000 Beechcraft Bonanza was purchased by a West Texas rancher for the little woman in 1960. The first year Neiman's featured the publicity-gathering his and her gift. And there are still a few Chinese junks, a 1962 his and her offering, plying the coast. A woman in Madrid purchased one of the ermine bathrobes, and a Hollywood TV star bought the gold wig, evidence that Texan extravagance is much imitated. Of course, there have been gifts that no one, not even a Texan, would buy. The 1978 his and her natural safety deposit box, a 150-foot-long hole in a granite mountain in Utah, was a bomb, as were the $50,000 dirigibles in 1979. Likewise, the his and her windmills in 1977 did not go like hotcakes, but they did reflect the times, which by then had become increasingly energy conscious. In 1970, in the midst of a recession, the store offered pessimists a modern Noah's Ark, complete with ballroom, swimming pool, microfilm library, and sauna, for $588,247. The next year produced the ultimate in transportation security, an $845,300 tank for the freeway. But if the Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog defines us in any way, we might read it and think that Texans have grown more restrained and sophisticated and less flamboyant in their extravagance. The 1997 catalog is filled with crystal sculpture, a battery-operated Toyota riding truck for kids, a year supply of Manolo Blahnik shoes, and, to remind us that we are not afraid of being thought crude, a $2,075 hand-painted porcelain melon and a Louis Vuitton steamer trunk that has been converted into a humidor. The his and her gift is a wind jet, a 6-person boat that holds 2 personal watercrafts and costs $32,600. None of those compares with the brilliantly ridiculous backyard ski slopes, camels, submarines, and wigs of gold. The innocence is gone. The X-Files, Sandy Duncan, by Rene Bonch. Published December 1996. Every Christmas from the time I was 3 until I was 10, my family would drive in a stream of cars to Kilgore, where, during the Depression and a very big oil boom, oil wells had been drilled downtown. Hundreds of derricks on street corners and next to office buildings would be decorated with colored lights. One year, I couldn't have been more than 5, we had only enough money to make the bills, so on the drive home, we stopped in the woods to cut down a Christmas tree. When we got home, we found a bird's nest with 4 eggs in the tree, and I wept that we had stolen a mama bird's eggs. My mother put the eggs outside for the mother bird to find. She must have actually dispensed with them. And to my way of thinking, the mother bird came back for them. It became a tradition for us to place a bird's nest in our Christmas tree every year. Actress Sandy Duncan was born in Henderson and grew up in Overton and New London. She's currently starring in That's Christmas, Chicago's Merry Musical, which runs through January 5th at Chicago's Schubert Theater.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
How sick are you? Niven Memorial Hospital offers a nurse triage program, 68 Nurse. The program is designed to help people determine whether their health situation warrants a trip to the emergency room. Midland residents can call the line by dialing 686-8773. The program is free and available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Local nurses are available to help you determine the best place to receive care for your situation. 68 Nurse can help you save time and money by directing you to the most appropriate healthcare option, whether it's a neighborhood clinic, urgent care center, emergency room, or just staying home. 686-8773.
This weekend, we kick off 4 weeks of Saturday night movies that are set in the Christmas season. We begin this Saturday with the romantic comedy, While You Were Sleeping.
I'm not working this weekend, Jerry.
Lucy!
Every day I go and I sit in a booth like a veal. I work every holiday. I go home to a cat.
For Lucy, loneliness was a way of life.
Joe Jr.'s still single.
Yeah, it's a shocker.
But the moment she saw Peter, she became a believer in love at first sight.
He was perfect.
Then fate stepped in.
Oh! Mister, there's a train coming!
Oh, God, you smell good.
Now she's part of his life.
He's in a coma.
Oh, I was going to marry him.
Who's she?
She's his fiance.
No.
Peter's engaged.
She saved his life.
Part of his family.
Hey, sis. Where's my, Lucy's going to marry my brother, Peter.
What? I didn't mean for this to happen. I don't know what to do.
Don't tell them a thing. Well, since they met you, they figured they have Peter back. They need you, Lucy. Just like you need them.
Come on, everybody.
And the grandmother, they just got this heart thing.
She had 3 attacks already.
Now, you tell them now, and you might as well shoot Grandma.
That's right. You haven't met Jack yet.
Welcome to the family.
Oh, thank you.
It's funny. My brother never mentioned you.
Which one of the 3 Stooges was Peter's favorite?
Curly.
Ha! He's everybody's favorite. Fact is, you're not really Peter's type.
All right. Whose type am I?
I like blondes.
You like brunettes.
Can I say, Peter, I was never envious of anything that you had until now.
You hacked it.
tell me what to do.
I like Jack.
Pull the plug.
You're sick.
I'm sick. You're cheating on a vegetable.
Caravan Pictures presents Sandra Bullock.
These are your husband's things.
Not my husband.
Your fiance.
Bill Pullman.
She drives you so crazy. You don't know whether to hug her or just arm wrestle her.
Peter Gallagher.
He's awake.
Your family's here, Peter.
In a film about love. At second sight.
Who are you?
While you were sleeping.
Shouldn't have left the booth.
Oh, shouldn't have left the booth.
Shouldn't have left the booth.
The audio described While You Were Sleeping, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow is falling and friends are calling you. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Let's take the road before us and sing a chorus or two. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. We're snuggled up together like birds of a feather would be. Let's take the road before us and sing a chorus or two. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
There's a Christmas party at the home of Farmer Gray.
It'll be the perfect ending of a perfect day.
We'll be singing the song we love to sing without a single stop.
At the fireplace while we watch the chestnuts pop. Pop, pop, pop.
There's a happy feeling nothing in the world can buy.
As they pass around the coffee and the pumpkin pie.
It'll nearly be like a picture print by Carrier Eyes.
These wonderful things are the things we remember all through our lives.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Let's take that road before us and sing another chorus for two. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
Ba 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 ba.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 37 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Make-believe.
ballroom time, the hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance, let's dance.
Hi, folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the make-believe ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world and welcome to the Make-Believe Ballroom. I'm Jeff Bressler and thanks for joining me this hour as we listen to some wonderful swing jazz and big band music and many of the stories behind the records that I am going to play on this broadcast. The rumba, at least the rumba played in big band style, became popular in the 1930s. It combined big band music with Afro-Cuban rhythms. For a while, there was a rumba craze that swept the country. Notable band leaders of the rumba included Xavier Cugat, Jimmy Dorsey, Nat Shilkret, and Leo Reisman. To get things started today, on the Brunswick label, Blame It on the Rumba, vocal by Gertrude Neeson, orchestra conducted by Cy Feuer, recorded in Los Angeles, January the 7th, 1937.
Permanent slave, start a permanent rave the very moment the rumba is played. I can't get hold of myself, I know it's bold of myself, but I'm afraid it's the way that I may. A siphonet or a peanut vendor will make me surrender, and so I say. If I find romance in your arms when we dance, claim it on the rumba. Feel a thrill, and my heart won't be still. Blame it on the rumba, blame it on the rumba. And while the music is playing, while all the lights are low, I'm not to blame if I'm saying I can't let you go. So why be discreet if our lips chance to meet? Blame it on the rumba. Blame it on the rumba.
I mentioned that Cy Feuer led the orchestra for Blame It on the Rumba, and I'm sure many of you who are also Broadway music fans just might be saying, is that the same Cy Feuer who was the famed Broadway producer? And the answer is indeed yes. Cy mounted some of the most notable titles in Broadway music history, including Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Both of those musical comedies won the Tony Award for Best Musical. Fuhr's greatest commercial career success certainly had to be the 1972 film version of Cabaret, which won 8 Academy Awards. Cy Fuhr. Bandleader Jimmy Greer was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but he grew up in Los Angeles, where he developed over several years to become one of the West Coast's most popular bandleaders during the 1930s. During the war, he followed Rudy Vallee as the leader of the Coast Guard band. Here's a goodie from Greer. On the Brunswick label, take a number from 1 to 10, Jimmy Greer and his orchestra, vocals by Betty Roth and the Three Cheers, recorded in Los Angeles, October the 5th, 1934. Although Jimmy Greer was a respected bandleader, his real mark on the history of the industry came as a composer with songs like this.
The object of my affection can change my complexion from white to a rosy red. Anytime he holds my hand, tells me that he's mine. There are many boys who can thrill me and some who can chill me, but I'll just hang around and keep acting like the clown until he says he's mine. Now I'm not afraid that he'll leave me. he's not the kind who takes a dare. But instead I trust him implicitly. He can go where he wants to go, do what he wants to do, I sure don't care. Oh, the object of my affection can change my complexion from white to a rosy red. Anytime he holds my hand and tells me that he's mine. The object of my affection can change my complexion from white to